you know.
Well, man, thanks for coming.
Yeah, dude. It's good catching up.
I know. We had some good conversation last night. It was all young divers, old divers, young judges, new, old judges, and then just talking a lot of
and
shit.
And they're good. Like, it's a good bunch because we know them, right? Like, most of them.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm sure.
I mean, old stories. Like, first question, all right? I asked them, I was like, top two divers.
Oh,
pick
boy.
Your top two favorite divers of all time.
That's such a tough question to ask, you know, like someone that's been around for so long, and judges especially. I can't imagine the type of responses you get.
But we broke it into two categories. The first category was, okay, growing up, who was the one diver first that inspired you? And then later on in your career, who is that second diver that just really took off?
And you're asking me.
But we asked all of them that,
okay.
But yeah, you too.
well, okay. And that's, I mean, I grew up in a time where I'm born in 85, so, you know, Louganis was already an it thing from a long time before I was born. And I remember being in elementary school, and I was so, obviously diving became already at that age, 7, 8 years old. Diving was taking up more and more space in my life and my head, my heart, you know, the dreaming was already happening, and Greg was such an inspiration, and the book, the movie came out. I was, and then quick anecdote, in school I would write my name on my papers, Alex Louganis, you know?
Like,
and so growing up, for sure, it was all about Greg. And then I had the privilege to dive alongside, well, many Chinese divers, the Tian Liangs of this world. Xiong Ni was around at the very beginning, you know, and then the ones in my generation, you know, Hei Chong, Ching Kai, we grew up in the junior levels together. So all of those guys, obviously, they push you every time. But Dimitri Salton, you know, another diver that changed the sport, that just brought it up to a whole other level, and having the chance to be around him and to get to know him and to talk to him, which eventually happened with Greg as well. You know, we've talked quite a bit. We're in touch as well when we can. And it's something very special to be able to say, I looked up so much to these guys, and to have the connection, and we both respect each other so much when we see each other. And with Dimitri, because he was around for a lot of my career, you know, there was a time where I, you know, he was obviously in the back end of his, and I was on the rise for mine, and to be on a podium and he's standing there beside me, but on a lower step, that was special. But all guys that just inspired and just wants you to be better.
Yeah.
You know? Like, just watching them train and compete, their attitude and how they react to wins, but, you know, failures as well, and how they bounce back.
Well, Greg didn't have failures.
True. Or very, very few.
Yeah.
But look how he bounces back from a failure, right?
Yeah. And, which is incredible.
And that's, I mean, the story tells itself, but I was very much an observer, trying to grab as much as I could. So, you know, there's it's one thing to idolize someone, but when they're, you know, in your reach to meet, to talk, to compete with, and I like to say with and not against, you know, especially in diving, it's been really, really good.
But I feel like Dimitri was definitely an against. And when he would compete, I mean, the guy was just a tank. He looked like he was just ready to go.
It's one of these characters where you just know it's going to be a battle, right? No matter what happens, even on a bad day, he's there. And magic can happen at any time.
Mm-hmm.
I remember, there's many moments, but we're in 2007 World Championships in Melbourne in the final on 3 meter. And he's diving right in front of me. I'm in the hunt for a medal in that event. And We're at the back end. I think fifth dive it was. I've got an inward 3.5 coming up, and I ended up in the event getting a silver medal, so it was a great day for me. But he's diving right in front of me. He's got a reverse 2.5 pipe, and I'm in the little stairwell, and he goes. Obviously, I hear the classic sound of a Dimitri dive, which is the absolute ripped entry and just the powerness.
Hard hand.
Just a powerful noise to it, and then the crowd goes absolutely nuts. So I'm standing there doing the best I can to focus on my own dive that's coming up because it's going well and I want to stay and focused and be in the run. And then there it comes, straight tens, you know, right in front of me and just moments before I have to go and perform. And I remember just breaking. And
what dive were you doing?
I'm inward 3.5. Okay. And so I'm standing at the back of the board and the crowd's going nuts and I hear, and they make it a point to say every single 10 when there's, when it's a perfect dive. And you know, with all due respect, it has to be that way. And I think it brings brings some emotion. And I broke and I was on the board just clapping like a fan. I am a fan and we just witnessed a perfect dive. So, you know, that's what Dimitri does to you. You think you got it all under control, and then he pulls out a magic trick, and it's amazing to be able to do that. So I did manage to snap back and do a really good inward 3.5. But again, you know, privileged to be able to witness, to be there, and you know, firsthand. I was right beside him when these things happened. And yeah, it's just, it is powerful.
Yeah.
It is motivating. It is, and he, also so humble. You know, Dimitri never.
What was he like?
Oh, he, I mean, very polite and very humble in victory and in perfect dives and the many that he's had and the perfect tens and the very, very many that he's had. Never any fireworks and like, you know, and I'm not saying it's wrong. It's just.
It
defines the person, you know, always kind of looking down and minding his own business. It goes back to the coach and just a little nod after a perfect dive. No hugging, no big ceremony, no big celebration. And I like that about him. You know, it's obviously the work speaks for itself. And
because he looked like he was just ready to kill someone when he could step out there. I mean, nicest, ready to go.
Nicest guy. Yeah, ready to go. But and that's what's. That's what's to learn, you know, and about the way he did it. It's like when it's time to compete, it's on.
It was on every phase time. Though, all the time. It just feels like it, from watching. I mean, I never got to watch him dive. I've watched a million videos of him dive.
Right.
But he just gets there. The buzzer goes off, and he goes immediately.
It's gone. Yeah.
Which I could never do. It's like he was waiting and itching for them to just. You know, come on, go,
right.
go. So he can.
I'm ready.
Yeah, he goes, I'm ready. You better pick up the pace.
It's true, and that is something that I picked up as well. Is you know, by looking at him, he goes right away. The concentrating part happens before.
Did you do that to them?
I did. I would take the extra second for like a deep breath before going, but when the whistle blows, the longer I would stay on the board, the longer it gives me time to think about something else. So I was trying my best to really just take a breath. I've gone through the motion before getting on the board anyways, and I like that way of doing things. And, you know, it's not by staying there an extra 20 seconds that things are going to get better, you know.
Yeah.
And so, but yeah, I mean, I wish for you and I wish for all the younger generations that they could have lived competing alongside and just witnessing events, because sometimes I was in the stands as well. And you know,
now did you watch during a competition, were you watching the meet as well? Okay, here's a good one. Did you think, or did you watch the scoreboard and watch the event, or did you completely stray away from that? That was one of the conversations we had last night with everybody else.
And I know that everybody's different for that. I did my best. First of all, I never watched ever.
Because
I tried once when I was younger, and then I see the scores. I see my total score after a certain amount of dives, and then I started calculating. I'm like, oh no, if I don't do a good dive now, that means I'm gonna be X amount of points behind. And then obviously nothing good came out of that at that point. So I decided to be done with that.
So you never looked at the scoreboard once?
Never looked at it.
Because some of the guys last night, they didn't have scoreboards.
Wow, that would have been great in our time
they
for me.
It. So it's like there's two mentalities that right. some of them had. Some of them didn't have scoreboards. So they could never watch. They didn't know who was
would
winning.
They have wanted to, though, is a good question as well. Would you have, because I a lot of divers do it, and that's fine.
Some love it.
Yeah.
I could.
Some need it. I just whatever screwed me up because I started calculating, some need that to push themselves hard to say, okay, I need 80 points on this one if I expect to win any kind of medal here. I also tried my best not to listen because obviously it's loud enough that you're aware of the few divers in front of you.
So did you use headphones?
No.
Never.
Tried to block it out as much as possible. Or, like, it's a psychological exercise as well, just to, you hear it, but you don't listen to it.
Yeah, you're training again.
You know? And I'm repeating the motions of what I have to do instead of paying attention to, like, I know what's going on. I know there's a great dive or a bad dive that just happened, which can open a window for me. That's all part of the process, I feel like. Your psychological work is to don't get too excited because the guy in front of you or the guy in the same battle as you, you know, just missed a dive because you still got to get up there and do your job as well. So to be able to focus either way, you know, it was an ongoing mental exercise that I kept doing without looking at the scoreboard, of course.
See, I couldn't do that. I had to have headphones. I watched scored once ever, and I was like, I'm done.
So, listen to music or like?
Yeah, always.
Okay.
I had to have something. But I couldn't, I had to go 80%. I could not go 100%. If I did that, I'd just get out of control. The hardest part was controlling everything I could do.
Yeah, and that extra spike of adrenaline competing as well.
It was a waste for me. I didn't like competing at all.
You chose the wrong field then because it's all about competing.
I love the training and working with Randy and Dario and working with them every day. They're great guys.
The whole family aspect of diving is...
That's what I loved.
Yeah. People ask me today, to this day, oh, do you miss it? And I'm like, I don't miss it at all. Like for one bit, I retired at the right time for the right reasons. The last couple of years, 2-3 years of diving were rough on the body, rough on the mind. I had accomplished everything I knew I was going to accomplish. Just like for me at 27 years old, to say, oh, I'm gonna go an extra 4 years because I want that Olympic gold medal, which is the only one missing for me in my career, but I saw what was going on, you know, with these kids coming up and these lists of...
207 and a 407B.
You know, like these lists of... Exactly. These lists of dives that are physically impossible for me to even fathom at that point. So there was a morning where I realized I'm okay, you know? So I don't miss the diving part of it. And it's, which I find is really good because I can sit at the pool and enjoy and watch great diving. You know, we're talking now, we're at the Junior World Championships and I see some kids, I see a nice dive, I get excited. I don't feel like I want to be on the board. But what I do miss is my friends, is the traveling with my friends, is getting to this competition, all going through some things together. Good or bad at the time.
The and pool then, deck banter.
And then we all get together at the end and have a good time. And then we'll see each other in a couple of weeks somewhere else in the world, you know? I do miss that. You know, catching up with you at these meets. We're the old guys now. I was handing out medals the other day. And I'm thinking that's when you know you're on the other side of things when they start asking you to hand out medals for the juniors and for the kids. But...
And these kids don't know.
No, and well, they know the name, but they're when
they don't know.
Now I
they
wear glasses.
Some of them know, but a lot of them.
Every single time, though, it's like, do you know? They always, or the people or coaches that introduce me go, do you know who this guy is? Kids are like, nah, and they say that's Alex DePatie. Oh yeah, I know, but which is fine, you know, like
they only know you from film.
from video, much like you and Dimitri, right? Like, they know the name, they know what's happened in their careers.
I mean, I didn't know you until...
the end, yeah.
Yeah, because I finished my career, I was a late bloomer. I didn't make my first international competition until 2013.
Right.
Which is the last Grand Prix in Fort Lauderdale.
2013, that
means... last Grand Prix in Fort Lauderdale until they closed the pool and didn't have any more meets.
Which, by the way, congratulations on that new pool.
Oh, my God.
It looks like it's out of a movie or something.
Yeah.
So hopefully I get invited there sometime to just
to
just hang out in Fort Lauderdale once again. Yeah, definitely back end.
Yeah, because you were, it was your back end, and I was just starting it. And you were done in when?
2012.
Yeah. So you were done then, and I just made the Grand Prix in Fort Lauderdale. I mean, I'd watched film, I'd seen...
We ran into each other
bit,
but...
on the pool deck.
But not much, yeah.
And mutual friends like Mickey and...
the guys. The band.
Exactly. That's like your touring band of boys.
Yeah, the Motley Crue, as I like to call us.
Who was it?
Oh, look, I got really close with the Italian guys. You know, Mickey, Tommaso... you know, Javi from Spain, mm-hmm. Javi Liana, of course. We, the Cubans, Jose Guerra is still to this day. These guys are all friends for life. It's one of these situations where we've gone through so much together.
Yeah.
And, like, when you think about it, like, we've traveled the world together.
The same group. You kind of have two groups of friends.
Exactly.
You have your diving group.
Exactly.
That you travel with, and then your friends at home, and it's like you leave... but it's like those people don't know the other life that you live. It's like you live two separate lives. And when you bring someone in, they're like, oh my gosh, this is different.
And yet your level of friendship is either the same or stronger even on in certain situations. So, those are the guys, Arturo, who became my coach towards the end. Mm-hmm. We were all, you know, and then there's more. Like some of the Chinese divers, I think with time... we were able to break some barriers because when I was a kid, there wasn't much hanging out for the Chinese team in terms of having a good time and communicating.
It's hard to talk to them.
It's really hard.
You see them all the time around the world and
true.
You try to communicate with them. You feel like you know them so well, but yet you may not.
Listen, I've had parties and we've had dinners and lunches with the Chinese divers without... almost like communicating, like talking to each other, but yeah, so this is the right way to put it. Without really talking to each other, because I don't speak Chinese, they didn't speak English at the time, but we still managed to have a great night together, you know? And what I really love right now, at least, the, you know, maybe the previous generation towards the end as well, it's like there was an effort from the Chinese divers to learn a bit of English, so that they could communicate with the rest of the world. And, and so there's an openness that happened throughout, you know, the past 20, 25 years. And they all became good friends as well. When we go to China, they want to take us out for dinner. When they come to Canada, we want to take them out for dinner.
Yeah,
have a good time. Which is the same for all the other guys in the crew. And again, friends for life. And I know if they come to Montreal and they need anything, I'm here. If I go to Italy, Spain, China, Australia, if I go somewhere around the world and I need someone to talk to or I need to find a place, what's good around here, they'll be there, you know? And that's what I think diving is. And for having been asked a lot, you know, is there intimidation in diving? I'm like... I want the other guy to do well so that we can all have a good time at the end, you know?
Exactly. I view it as like golf.
Yes.
If I make a mistake, it's not your fault.
Uh-huh.
If all the golfers are friends.
True.
And they, you know, it's a very similar thing. It's all on me. It's not on you unless you're doing synchro.
Yep. But we're all pushing each other to be better, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. This guy just nailed it. I got to step up now and nail it too, you know? And it's never... wishing something bad or like wishing a missed dive to the for the other guy. It's the opposite thing, you know. A great event just brings something out of you that maybe you didn't know, and we're all buddies at the end, you know. Mm-hmm. There's no like I can't wait to run into that guy again, because you know there's none of that. Like it's never happened to me in 22 years of diving. So and I love that it's the sport I chose. Yeah.
Now you had a great group of friends. Arturo, you dove with.
Yep.
And he was your coach. Now, what was the introduction of synchro like? You know, you did synchro with Arturo.
I did.
Yeah. How did that start? And then, what was it like when you first started doing synchro? And did you have a different mentality when you're diving? Because it does change when you're, it's more of a, I'd like to call it a dance, because you're working on the rhythm
right.
and the timing with that person all the time.
Well, first of all, I was, there was a short period of a couple of years, you know, and I'm thinking 1998 Commonwealth Games for me. There was no synchro, right? So I was there at the very start. We showed up to a World Cup in 1999 in New Zealand, and Canada, we had a couple of guys on the team, and they're like, oh, there's synchronized diving at this World Cup. You want to get together? And not myself, I was too young, but a couple of the guys, want to get together? Yeah, we can do this, this, and that, and we'll see what happens. They looked like absolute idiots, you know? Because then that's when we realized, at least here in Canada, where, people have been training for this. Like, this is not just we'll snap our fingers and show up and pretend that, that we can do it. It takes a lot of work, takes a lot of time. Like you say, it's a dance. You gotta put the time in with your partner to really get that rhythm. So for me, I had a few different partners before diving with Arturo, but Arturo...
Who did you start with? Who's the first ever?
Philippe Contois.
Okay.
On platform, because me being so small at the time...
How old were you?
It's easier. I was 15?
Jeez.
Something like 15, 16. And Phil was a bit older than me, but... Two different sort of shapes of bodies are easier to pair on platform than it is on springboard, yep. for obvious reasons. The weight and everything. So it took a while for me to grow into somewhat of a man. I can't even say that at 37 I feel like a man yet.
So it's never going to change.
So, yeah, exactly. Young at heart forever. It took some time for me to be able to keep up with the guys on the springboard. So Arturo came along, became Canadian over the year of 2000. And then eventually we just did, say, hey, why not give it a try? And there was a whole idea behind it where we had similar bodies. He was a good friend of mine. So I figured, like, hey, let's try it for fun, see if there's potential. We had some great results together, and it was an opportunity for him too to compete in the Olympics mm-hmm. over time, because he had qualified in 1992 for Cuba, but mm-hmm. Wasn't able to compete.
Yep.
The country decided there was no medal potential, so you're staying home.
Jeez, that's yeah. gonna be hard.
Yeah, terrible. So then when we saw that there was a potential, we were second at Worlds in 2007 in Melbourne. This was a chance for him to be a competitor. So he was 37 when he competed in Beijing. Mm-hmm. We got fifth. Obviously, it would have been great to win a medal, but at least he can say, he was an Olympian because we dove synchro. So that was fun, really fun. And then there was a period where he was... we were competing together, and he was coaching me a little bit
yep.
around those years. I would go train in Miami because at the time he was living there, so it would be a great way to get away from home. And
is that when you were training in Miami? Who was there? Ruben wasn't there.
No, that would have been a few years back. But you mentioned Randy earlier, and I'm like Dario and the guys, and
yeah,
just being out there was such a treat.
I mean, you got the sun, you got the pool.
The sun, the pool, the
it's
gang,
in the middle
another
of
gang.
Campus, yes. overlooking a beautiful lake. You're going to dinners at Randy's house.
Yeah, those were the days.
Yeah.
Those were definitely the days. Yeah.
And then you started doing synchro with, was there a jump or a gap between you doing with Arturo and then Ruben?
Well, right after Arturo retired and became my full-time coach, that's when we tried, because at that, obviously by 2008, like, synchro was no longer optional. It's like, no, Canada, like, we want to be a competitive country in synchro as well. Like, for everyone, it just became a natural event. Like, mixed synchro is now, and, like, eventually, for all the countries, high diving is going to become another medal opportunity, right? Yeah. So as soon as he retired, it's not easy to find the right partner for everyone. You can't just pick it out. So Ruben and I started diving together because he had to move to Montreal, obviously, mm-hmm. like mm-hmm. for it to work. There's no way by 2008 that you can just have two guys at separate ends of the country and they just meet a week before.
Mikey and I started diving 2.5 months before we competed.
Look at you.
But I moved there. I went to Indiana basically for those 2.5 months, 2 months.
Right.
And then we went into Olympic trials.
Well, 2.5 months is a good chunk, but it's not that much when you think about it.
Not at all.
Yeah.
But on paper, it looked good, so we went with it.
Yeah, get you out of the house, out of home.
It did. It got us out of the house and got it into gear. But it can either mesh very well or it can be a long term. You know, it could take forever,
or not work at all. You know. It's all about adaptability and being able to make compromise, and for me that's the way it works. Obviously you need two divers that are
and you got to play their strengths
and also, like,
you diving with someone who does a great reverse but you struggle with reverse, it's not going to help you.
It's not. You got to be able to pair the right dives and everything, and but then now with time, like what I like to see when it started is when you would get a couple of guys that individually had no chance, or women like had no chance to be in the top contenders, and then suddenly you put them together in a synchro event, maybe less DD, and back then that wasn't too bad in the end because mm-hmm. everybody was kind of doing the same dives. Nowadays it's like warfare out there.
Yes. How do you do a synchro 207?
Exactly. Well, meter? They do.
Exactly. I don't know how. Did you ever do that dive?
I attempted to do it. I was in that time where physically it was out of the question for me to make it.
It's a lot of dive. I mean, that's, I feel like it's 4-0.
I feel it's 10-0. That's how I felt about it when I.
But
when
like I tried. It's what, 3.7, 3.6, which isn't. It's not.
It's not. It's not enough.
Yeah,
that's how
I didn't think
it is.
So. You know, front's easier, triple out's easier, mm-hmm. but that is.
Well, I mean, it's part of the evolution of the sport, which I love. You know, specialization.
Yeah.
I dove 3 meter and 10 meter for the longest time.
And did you do 3 meter, 10 meter, and synchro at the same time?
I did, because there was a time where I did 3 meter synchro and 10 meter synchro as well. So.
Jeez.
That was more around like 2004. But those were the days like where that was, there was a lot of guys that would do both, you mm-hmm. know? Nowadays, if you're on both, you're wasting time on the other one.
Unless you're like a housing where you can do everything.
Yeah.
I mean, that guy.
Yeah, he's an exception, which is a fabulous exception because spectacular diver. And he would keep up with the DD as well.
Yeah, he had most of it.
Yeah, I mean,
he was doing reverse 3.5 bike on 3 meter.
I know.
Competing it. And
reverse 2.5, 2.5 as well.
Yeah.
Oh, no, like so.
What a guy, though. Yeah. What a guy. Looks extremely serious all the time, but yet you meet him and you're like.
Yeah, nice guy.
Oh, man, but he loves to crack jokes, mess around. He's one of the boys.
To see the evolution, though, is like where the guys are. And also, like, body types which are made to dive 3 meter or made to dive 10 meter, which allows them to make a back 3.5 tuck or an inward 3.5 pike or a front 4.5 tuck look like a
like
simple,
nothing.
Breezy walk in the park, you know?
We were talking last night about the, you know, like Yona Knight is putting the board in the water on 1 meter. Do we need to move the board up? Do we need a 1.5 meter? Because they have the
high
dive.
He would put the board in every time.
But we have the high dive events. It's going to make 3 meter look like it's nothing. So
I think
I
beg to differ. I think the 3 meter is always going to be
a standard,
a very spectacular event.
But imagine if we had a 5 meter springboard.
That would be something else. Or let's throw it out there. See.
Or a 2 meter springboard.
2 meter even.
Imagine front 4.5 on 2 meter.
I think if we're gonna go for it, we should definitely do like a 5 meter springboard. But 2 meters is just another 1 meter.
But how do we incorporate that? Because that's like, you know, you've got the high. Do we throw it in a high diving event and let them start playing with it?
Could be. Good. You got a bunch of good ideas. Look at you.
This was a conversation we were having last night. It's like, do we take that 5 meter event, throw it into high diving, let them play with it, and see if it'll transition into the rest of the sport?
You know what's funny?
Do we do that for, you know, do we add the 2 meters so people aren't dipping in the water? Is there?
Well, okay, you're involved with these springboards. I don't think they can dip a 2 meter springboard.
I don't, no.
I don't think it bends that much.
I mean, we could measure it, but I mean, we'd have to take Yona.
I mean, we've seen a few guys break a board, right? So if you keep bending,
did you break any?
No, I tried.
I never broke one.
I was wanting to, but I never managed to crack one of them. I would hit the water on 1 meter as well, but not enough to break a board.
Is it? I've cracked, but I've never broken. I've always dreamed of it.
It's pretty good.
I mean, you look at it.
It's like becomes a challenge.
It's like, who cracked it? Like, we don't know, but there's a tiny crack on the underside of the board.
Yeah. No good anymore. Switch it up. Get new boards.
Yeah, because, I mean, they go quick.
Yeah.
Especially with the guys now. I mean, Yona's broken. I don't know how many boards.
I mean, Yona was a specimen, you know? Like, he was his own.
No, different Yona. Yona Knight Wisdom.
Oh. Oh, yeah, from Jamaica.
He puts the board like 8 inches in the water.
Well, he's also 8 feet tall, and I don't
know. He looks 8 feet tall standing next to every other diver. Like, how tall are you? 6'4"? And he's like, I'm not that tall, but.
Jeez, I know. Yeah. Well, the other Yona used to, he probably broke a few boards himself back in our day from Finland.
He was like I think he was a modern day Greg.
True. Very, very elegant diver. And he never budged on his, what can I say, his style, you know? Never bent his feet or legs or never, everything was, always nice there. And proper.
Yeah. He kept it very clean all the time. Which is, it's kind of a mentality in a sense, because you're always just looking to stay the same, but some people, when they're in panic mode or scrambling, things go real quick.
But I also find, and this is sort of, maybe I'm a purist for this, but I find that with time, the beauty of it kind of got lost in translation, maybe. And the, you know, the
now that things are getting harder?
The amount of dive and the obviously the entrance, you know, the entry in the water and the least possible amount of water coming out just became the priority. I love the Greg style. I love the Yona style. It was a point for me to, not in training, but in competition. Don't bend your legs. Just and just work on that finesse, you know. And that's what made it look easier. Made it look.
It's aesthetically pleasing.
Aesthetically pleasing, but also, it's just an entirely different flair to the dive, and it's a beauty that you know, men or women like the line and the legs and the feet and the arms and the smoothness of it. It just brings something else in the dive that I think with time we've lost a little bit. You know?
Mm-hmm. And it depends on how the coaches coach. I think that's heavily
what the judges want to see.
But it's dependent on the coaches to them to, you know, train those skills within them. It's like, all right, are you going to drop your arms in your hurdle and start bending your knees? Are you going to hold, wait, even if you have a terrible hurdle. When do you break? When do you not break? Mm-hmm.
So, arms going like all kinds of ways in the hurdle. Like, there is an aspect to that is...
Because Dimitri always had the arms and then
he'd drop one. And the one bending. But it also shows not giving up. You could easily just stop, or you could easily just, you know, bail in the middle of the dive. Mm-hmm. But when you see that there was a struggle, that's why, like, one of my coaches, Michelle Arushi, always told me, especially diving on springboard, because there's just more chances of screwing up, you know, with the board and the approach to the end of the board. And he always said, you don't necessarily need a perfect takeoff to do a perfect dive. So the struggle, you know, on the board, you're stuck in a corner. You're readjusting your whole body just to get off and jump in the air and then eventually land perfectly in the water. And that creates a wow factor for the judges and say, you know what, this guy never gave up. He could have fell off the board. Instead, he stuck with it. For me, that's a perfect example. So,
okay, 2000, what year was it when it was Barcelona? You were doing 307.
No, Montreal.
It was Montreal. Sorry. I was 307, and you were.
I was a solid foot behind the board.
Yeah.
I've watched and watched again and again, and I have no idea how I even managed to land on my head.
But do you think that was a matter of the adrenaline? Do you think it was a matter of the way that you trained? Because have you taken hurdles like you've had to have taken hurdles like that in the pool before and been fine?
I have, and that's what the whole point of repetition is that you've gone through every situation before. But oh man, this was Montreal 2005, you know, world championships, I'm at home, heavy favorite to win. The amount of pressure is hard to even describe. I don't want to drag on this, but there was a whole mess that happened around those world championships where the organizing committee, there was a lot of drama there. We almost lost the event.
Really?
And then 3 months before, somebody came in to sort of save it. I was a spokesperson for the event. So all of this was happening at the same time. All the pressure and the weights on my shoulders and Emily Heyman's, she took a bit of it as well.
Jeez.
And
you're trying to train throughout this.
Trying to survive, really. Because, like, mentally, oddly enough, on the competition days of that week, I just kind of, like, I shut everything else down, you mm-hmm. know? And it was all about competing. And part of me was like, I just want it to be over so I could move on with my life. You know, like, this will be behind me and I can keep going. And then I started with the 3-meter event. Well, there was synchro before, but the main event was the 3-meter. Getting to the final, and yeah, I stood on that board and that 307, and I don't know. I knew, you know, when you're in the hurdle, you're at the end of the board, and I could see the end of the board. That's how far back I was.
You, yeah.
I could see that there's so much board in front of my toes, and I just stuck with it. I didn't panic. I just... So that to me, and I hate to be talking about it in a way, like, this is a perfect example of, look, the guy, like, this shouldn't have happened, you know? Yeah. But it did. And so I got a few tens for that dive. So the not giving up until the dive is over.
Yeah.
You know how easy it would have been for me to just turn around and start over? I just went for it, you know? And it paid off in the end, obviously.
Now, do you make changes in the air? Are you making, are you, while you're competing, are you thinking that at all, or are you just in the autopilot?
In that one, it was flat out autopilot.
But you typically don't think?
I do think. I try not to, because I get drifted away very easily. But for that event, I was good until the last dive. Well, because even for 307, you know, on the board, like I said, no panic, just stick to what it is, get up in the air, take your time, keep your eyes open, mm-hmm. you know, go aggressive at the end as well. And that worked out. And after that dive too, there was a quick second, because I was focusing on the next one.
Yeah.
Quick second where I was swimming back to the side of the pool, and I was like, what just happened here? I even looked like Michelle, my coach at the time. He just kind of went, okay.
No one expected it.
First of all, nothing to say. And like, there's no point in saying anything after the scores. But even him, and I saw it on his face, he was like,
you're both raising your hands like,
okay, you just did that. So good.
Keep
focus
going.
Focus on the next one.
Keep going.
So, but then I get to my last dive, which is double out, and you know, we spoke earlier about trying to not listen, not watch the scoreboard, not listening to other guys' scores. Yeah. Troy Dumais was in the hunt for a gold medal in that event as well. But I'm standing there in the back, and the house announcer, Rod McCormick, which everyone knows in the world of diving, Rod goes, and I couldn't help but hear, because it's everywhere, you know, like it's even though we're outside. And he says, ladies and gentlemen, it goes something like, we might be witnessing something historic here, the first ever diver to break the 800-point mark.
No.
And then I heard that, and I knew he was talking about me, because he didn't mention my name, but you just kind of know when you're having a great event.
Headphones would have been nice.
Yeah. You should have told me that at the time.
I don't know if I was born then. I was still in diapers.
And so I'm in the back there, and that kind of straddled me a little bit. And all I thought about for the last dive was, please don't buckle or like fall off the board or anything like that. Just
keep it easy.
Just land on your head, you know, like forget the 800 mark, forget all of that. Just, if you land on your head, you're going to win this event, and it's all good, like, you know, and you've done it and it's fine. So that's all I focused about. I went long a little bit, but it was good enough to win and break 800 points. So, which is the last time that'll ever happen at that level anyways. Because that was the last event where we had compulsory volunteers. Yeah. So that all kicked in later on. But
saves a lot of time not having those.
Yeah. Also, you know, it changed it. Like at the time, it changed the whole dynamic, because
you get, did you view using voluntaries as like a warm up, so to speak, like for your hurdle, your back press?
Like I did enjoy doing voluntaries. It is long, but go back to the finesse, you know, and the beauty of diving. You know, that's something that I enjoyed watching. It doesn't have to be always twists and turns, and I know they're very spectacular, but the precision and beauty of a well-executed front one-half pike or front one-half full twist, you know, a reverse one-half half twist, like just effortless.
Yeah.
I enjoyed that, but it also brought a different level of diving in the sense that now you got to put six hard dives together three times in the day. You know?
Did your mentality change, you know, once they got rid of those? It's like you're starting immediately now. You're going from 0 to 100. Mm-hmm. You've got no, so to speak,
It didn't
buffer.
Change the mentality, but it did sort of, it took some time, I think, for everyone to, you know, you go back to zero. It's not like you had a solid five voluntaries on 3 meter, and then you're 25 to 30, sometimes 25 points ahead of like the third, fourth place. Meanwhile, now it's all back to zero every time, right? We all adapted, and I think it just also changed the concept of your score. Then it was about breaking 500 points. You know, that was the big mark. Now on platform, it's 600 points, which is completely, it's absolute madness to me to even imagine that. But that's where we are.
Yeah.
You know, that's
the evolution of it all.
Absolutely.
Now, speaking of change, did your mentality change on going from individual to synchro? Because, I mean, when I was doing synchro, I loved it because I didn't think as much. I was focused on the rhythm, the timing, and what my partner was doing. I didn't have to, you know, they were relying on me to do good. I did better under pressure from someone else that I was training with because I wanted to serve them.
Do good for the team, yeah.
Yeah, whereas it's like if I made a mistake, it was my fault. So when I was training individually and competing individually, I had to tell myself, okay, I'm doing this dive for my coaches. I'm doing this for someone, because if it was for myself, it didn't mean as much to me.
Right.
Whereas in synchro, it's different.
It did change. Like, it's a lot like you. You just, it's almost like you think less about your dive and just paying attention. Okay, he's good on the other end. Perfect. Like, I can do my dive.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Less focus on my own technique points and just, okay, just follow who's beside you.
Yeah.
And it's interesting how the mind works, because most of the time it works fine, but you know, you really have to split the two, your dive and your team.
Yeah.
And to they're kind of going parallel, but not together in the same junction, right?
Now, did you have conversation with him, your partners, while you were competing? Or like, I told Mikey I didn't want to have conversation.
Right.
He's a totally different diver than I am. I'm listening to John Mayer trying to chill out, and he's trying to kill someone. So it was like our first conversation.
That's got to be pretty heavy on you.
It was. So I told him, I'm like, from the very first time we started training, I said, dude, I know you compete different than I do. Let's keep talking to a minimum. We'll get to the board, we'll talk, we'll do our dives, and then let's go back to doing our own thing. Mm-hmm. So we came together, did our dives, and that was it. And then it's like, who's in charge of doing, you know, if I'm off a little bit, do I make the change or does he make the change?
Right.
Who's in charge of that? So it's a delicate conversation.
But I feel like there's always a leader.
Yeah.
For example, the person that counts.
Yeah.
Like, you have to establish at the start, whether it's your first partner or multiple partners in the end, like every time you start with someone new, okay, there is a follower,
yeah.
You know, just you go and I'm going to follow you.
Yeah.
And so as soon as that's established, and it's not a matter of I'm better than you or not. It's just for us to work together, we can't be going individually, right? We got to always follow each other. And so I think that, that takes some time to even you know, grasp and understand. But never did we, much like you, during a competition, try and adjust things. You know, there's always, like with stress or anything like that, there's going to be hesitations here and there.
Yeah.
And springboard, once again, just brings a whole different level of synchronization than platform. But after a dive in synchro, other than, you know, the individual aspect of it, like, oh, I messed up main word, I was too far back, or I came out too early, none of like that maybe would happen, just to tell the other guy what happened after a missed dive. But never would we say, look, in the hurdle, we got to start working on this or that, because that creates a whole lot of doubt during the event. It's more like a thing you bring back to training and go back to the drawing board, and just more reps and reps and reps and reps, and be comfortable with the guy on the other side.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now on the competitive side, you know, your heart rate's through the roof.
Yeah.
All the time. I mean, for me, I was...
Not all the time. So, yeah.
Like,
so,
it's hard for me, it was hard to control.
Yeah. For me, beginning and end. In between, I was always kind of coasting.
So did you put your harder dives in the middle?
I would.
And you put
307 always right in the middle.
Yeah. So you started off with your strong dives.
Strong and comfortable.
Yes.
So on 3 meter, for me, it was back to an half pike. So I know, first of all, gosh, it's not a hurdle. So I was like, okay, crack the nerves right away.
Yeah.
Fairly easy dive. No need to say. And
for you, I hated that dive.
Well, for me, it's a fairly easy dive. Just get going with a, you know, comfortable one as well. And then front, just to get the first hurdle out of the way.
Yep.
Then 307. And then reverse twist, then inward, then then the double out. So that's how, double out, same thing, higher degree of difficulty, hurdle, but
it's a front takeoff.
Relatively comfortable with that at the end as well, to go and get some good points as well. It's all a strategy for everyone. I mean, some guys would start with 307 or finish with it, which I never understood.
Like Chris.
Chris Colwell, I know.
Yeah.
I don't know how, I mean, it's a make or break. He can, you know, I'm sure he's won a lot of events because of that.
But I think he had an advantage. He was deaf. No, seriously, but he was deaf. So I think that just put him in tune visually more. I mean, his spotting had to be on point then. You know, he can't hear as well. I think that
you'd have to ask him.
I That's how, my theory.
How he goes through through a dive being deaf. Emily Heyman's too doesn't hear well from one of her ears.
Really?
And but I never asked her if that impacted anything. She did pretty good too.
I mean, they say your senses get better, so I would assume that he was more in tune with other parts of his body because of that.
Yeah.
But so on the competitive adrenaline side, you don't have that now.
No. But I did pick a job that I love and that brings me those butterflies in the stomach, you know.
That's
being speaking in front of people, in front of a camera. You know, I work in the media, so it's either a radio show, a TV show. It's live mm-hmm. a lot of times, which I love. I'm seeing events, you know, that also there's some work to be. Like, there's a lot of similarities, a lot of prep, a lot of you know, obviously knowing what you're going to talk about, getting to know the people you're talking to. And I get those butterflies before every show, before everything. The day that I won't have that, I'll know that, you know,
it's
probably time to move on to something else. And I mean, I got a buddy of mine out here, freestyle skier, mm-hmm. two-time Olympic champion. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of...
So you ski?
A lot of... I'm sorry?
You ski?
I do ski, but not moguls. You know, he does... he's a moguls Olympic champion twice. Very competitive. Also, like, obviously, that brought a lot of adrenaline. He mm-hmm. was the first to win a gold medal on Canadian soil in 2010, the Vancouver Olympics.
Wow.
Because we hadn't done that in the past times we hosted. And he's an accountant. So I'm like, how do you go from all this adrenaline and all these rushes to live your life, you know, pounding numbers on spreadsheets and stuff? But look, he's great at what he does. And I think he finds a way to get the challenges. But for me, I could never do that. I need... to be in a situation where every once in a while I'm being put out of my comfort zone. Mm-hmm. 'Cause that's the thing too, I think for everything, don't get comfortable. It's one thing to be in control, but to get too comfortable means you gotta shake things up every once in a while, because that's what keeps you on your toes and keeps you getting better and improving at what you're doing, you know?
So getting uncomfortable, retirement's not easy.
No.
How uncomfortable was that? I mean, it's everybody struggles with it. It's not
right.
You have this sport. You have a very small window of time mm-hmm. to compete, and then after a while, that's gone.
That's gone.
That window, but then you have to transition on. And a lot of people, myself, I struggled with it for 2 years.
Right.
I couldn't figure it out.
Yeah. So in my case, so in 2012, everything kind of happened. In a good way, in the sense that, like, I had a job that was sort of offered to me and getting lined up while I wasn't quite retired yet. Mm-hmm. I had to do a lot of rehab on a knee after the London Games and ended up getting surgery. And so I was going to dive it one more year, like get to those 2013 Barcelona World Championships. Mm-hmm. That was my objective. And then I never dove again. But then I woke up one morning and realized, and I mentioned it before, like I've done what I had to do in this sport. Yeah. And so for me, it's time. I'm comfortable and very, I accept the decision. I accept that my time's over. But I started working right away. So this gap or this emptiness of being done didn't happen at the time. And the job that I got was being the host of a morning show. So mm-hmm. on TV, first time working on an actual, like, full show, live TV, all new things to me. I'd been in a million interviews before, but now there's a technicality to it, you know, yeah. multiple cameras, with having an earpiece, all kinds of new challenges to being in front of a camera. So I didn't have the time to really dwell on my diving career, because the new job started right away. But then I was there for about 2.5 years. And once that stopped and I became a freelancer and had more time on my hands mm-hmm. Over a certain period of time, then it hit, you know? And I was like, what am I doing here? Or what's my purpose here?
It's hard. That's people struggle with that.
And yeah, it's hard, but I think it's, again, the similarities is you got to get to work. You got to be able to, especially nowadays, be open-minded about learning new things, new technologies. You can't be what's the expression? You can't be like a one job kind of guy. You got to keep up with what's happening.
Multifaceted or something like that.
Exactly. Yeah. You got to be able to do more than one thing. Otherwise, you're behind. Because the 18-year-old coming up, he knows everything that's going on, and he can do everything more than what you thought was enough back
Plus
then.
Plus TikTok.
Know? Yeah. Yeah, don't even go there, you know? So this is the time we're in, and people have to adapt. And I say it not as if I'm, you know, saying I'm doing what I what I'm promoting. It's hard for me to adapt for certain things, but we have to. Like, there's just no other way, really.
Yeah. But there's a lot of people that struggle. They don't know what to do. They had right. diving, and all they had was diving, and they retire, and it's gone.
Yeah.
And then they're sitting there like, what's next?
Yeah.
Or it's like, you know, you win these huge events, and you're like, all right, I completed that, and now what?
Yeah, so I always tell younger people and athletes, whichever sport, you got to start thinking about that while you're in it.
Yeah, you
even
have
though,
to. But some don't.
Even though that can be difficult in itself for a lot of athletes, you got to start thinking about the next step of your life, and even not too far ahead. But I always say, like, once the time comes, for whatever reason, at least you have a list of places to go, the direction you want to take. Doesn't have to be so precise, but you know you want to be in finance, you know you want to be in business, you know you want to be an artist, or you want to be a musician, you want to, whatever it is, at least you know, okay, that's where I'm going, and then however much time it's going to take for me to get settled in. But you're not in that situation that you just mentioned where you're like, I have no clue what I want to do and what my purpose is going to be for the next 45 years of my life, or you, because that, I always say that one day turns into a week, turns into a month, turns into a year, turns into you're in trouble.
Yeah.
You know,
you
you're
keep
in serious
pushing
trouble.
Off saying it's future Sam's problem, future Alex's problem.
Right. When you got a side job here, a side job there, but you still are not happy because you don't know what you're doing or what you really want to do. And so you got to have an idea of what it is that's going to drive you and get you those butterflies again. Or they don't have to be butterflies, it's just an expression, but what's going to make you happy at the end yeah. of the day, you know? And and to make sure that, especially in the world we live in now, it's like, focus on you a little bit. What's going to make you smile when you wake up? And even if you're tired at the end of the day, you did something you loved, and it's not about just having to do it. You did it because you wanted to, you know?
Yeah. And not even necessarily something that makes you money. It's like, if you're having a good time doing it.
Exactly. You can eat. You have a roof on top of your head. You know, have a couple vacations a year if you can. Even yep. though you're not flying away, just have some time for yourself. That's what it's all about, you
yeah.
know?
Yeah. Well, cool, man.
Dude.
This Appreciate is good. It.
Yeah, man.
Good we can catch up.
Yeah.
Talk
good
shit.
Good catch up. Yeah. It's good. You're good at this.
I try.
Yeah, man.